Slate spoiler specials are brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/spoiler.
Hi, I'm Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with the Slate spoiler special podcast on Total Recall, the new Len Wiseman movie based on a Philip K. Dick short story. Here with me in the Slate studios is Chris Wade. Hey, Chris.
Am I really Chris Wade, or am I actually Hauser, the secret agent inside of me? It's great to be here, Dana.
Chris, you are a Slate V producer, and you're also the producer of the Slate spoiler specials, and you also specifically asked to come along and spoil this movie with me because you're a big sci-fi fan and a big Total Recall fan.
Yeah, I'm a fan of all of Verhoeven's sci-fi works. A few months ago, when they announced the Starship Troopers remake, I wrote a little piece for Browbeat about why all of Verhoeven's sci-fi movies are particularly relevant these days.
Why is that? Because of their sort of relevance to virtual reality?
All three of them are kind of weirdly prescient and forward-looking to a lot of ways that people interact with technology and memory.
The three that are being remade, you mean? This one, RoboCop, and Starship Troopers.
Yeah, and it's also just interesting that Verhoeven kind of... I thought it was interesting that Verhoeven's, like, aesthetic weirdly hit a cultural moment where 2012... the Total Recall remake is coming out, 2013 the RoboCop remake is coming out, and if all goes according to plan, 2014 the Super Troopers remake, or Starship Troopers remake, comes out. So I just think that he has a kind of interesting, prescient, snarky take. All the stuff in Starship Troopers about where it's like framed by that YouTube video concept, the would you like to know more, where you're constantly watching these.
You're right. Well, Starship Troopers, I haven't rewatched since, I've seen it since it came out, but not in a while. And that movie just blew me away. Okay, we can't even get off into Starship Troopers because I think that is Verhoeven's finest work. And we're not even here to talk about Verhoeven, although I'm sure we will reference him at some point. We're here to talk about Len Wiseman's remake. Len Wiseman is the director of the Underworld movies, which, can you tell me about them? Because I've never seen an Underworld movie.
They were kind of a little in front of the Werewolves and Vampires thing that the first one probably came out in like 2005, but it's basically Kate Beckinsale is a badass unstoppable killing machine of a vampire fighting a war.
But she's not an occult figure herself. She's a person.
No, she is a vampire. She's part of the vampire clan and she's fighting a war against the Lycans or the werewolves who have traditionally been enemies with the vampires, even as she finds herself falling in love with one.
And you like those movies. They're okay.
Yeah, they're pretty okay. They were kind of a great entry into that concept before it got way, way overplayed. Like, that was probably the first vampires versus werewolves action flick I can remember seeing. I'm sure there are more before that, but that was one of the big Hollywood things. And it was kind of, you know, it was like a $30, $40 million movie when it came out. Not the hugest, like, blockbuster thing, but, you know, a really good, passable action movie, much like this one.
Yeah, Len Wiseman is also married to Kate Beckinsale in real life, which I think figures into the fact that he, to me, vastly overestimates how much we care about Kate Beckinsale's character, but we will get there. So the basic premise of Total Recall, which is based on this Philip K. Dick short story called We Can Remember It For You Wholesale. Like all Philip K. Dick stories, it has an amazing title that doesn't really work as a movie title because it's too long and too conceptual, like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, right, for Blade Runner? So the basic premise of this story, although it's very, very short, it's probably like less than 10 pages long, the story, but it's so cinematic. I can completely see why people would want to return to it again and again to make movies. Do you want to take us through the kind of Mobius strip logic of the story?
Yeah, like you said, it's just a really great movie premise that you can set up the log line for the entire story in a sentence, which is basically a guy who has these insistent dreams of another reality goes to a service that offers to implant memories in him. And as soon as the needle goes in his arm or the visor goes over his head to theoretically start the memory implant, everything seems to go awry and cops bust in and he's basically launched on this extended chase where he realizes that he's secretly a super agent or secret agent who's had his memory wiped. But then there's this whole interplay of, is this a crazy truth that's been triggered by him messing with his brain through recall, or is it all actually the memory he paid to have implanted in him.
Right. Since the thing that he asked to do, well, in the original Verhoeven, he asks to go to Mars. They mm-hmm. take out the Mars angle in this, which we'll talk about. But he essentially wants to take sort of a virtual vacation, right, and pretend to be a super agent spy. And so we don't know throughout the movie whether he is a guy on a table just writhing in the grips of a crazy delusion or whether, in fact, he was a secret agent and has now accidentally triggered that memory. And I think especially the Verhoeven 1990 version really walks the line and is careful at every moment to let both realities possibly be true. I think I get the impression that this movie is a little bit less interested in that, you know, in sort of reversing the Mobius strip over and over again.
Yeah, and I do think that that is one of the most fascinating parts of the original Recall, in that it toes that line very carefully. And when the movie ends, you know, you can still find people debating, like, what is it real? Did he actually go to Mars, or is he stuck in his schizoid embolism?
Right. Yeah, a phrase that, as you observed, sadly dropped out. The sort of pseudo-medical phrase, schizoid embolism, for what happens to him mm-hmm. on the implant table, it has disappeared, probably because of its completely non-medical absurdity, but I missed it.
Yeah, we've kind of wised up as a culture. But, yeah, it's just one of those great science fiction mumbo-jumbo phrases that just sounds so great but is replaced in this movie by, you know, paranoid delusional psychosis or, you know, something that sounds more realistic.
Similarly, the idea of Mars or the destination of Mars as the place that he dreams of and tries to go back to in his bot memory has dropped out of this one. And mm-hmm. I mean, I assume that that's just because now we know enough about the solar system. And I don't know, that I think science fiction has gotten kind of sophisticated and pseudoscientific enough that we wouldn't really buy this whole story about going to Mars and the oxygenless atmosphere of Mars and living inside a dome and all the things that happened in the first one. And so instead, what Wiseman has done essentially is make Earth into the uninhabitable planet. So there's also kind of an eco angle in this version where chemical warfare has made the Earth completely uninhabitable, except for some reason for Great Britain and Australia.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's this colonial thing set up. This is all, by the way, there's a little exposition dump at the beginning, right? There's just words printed on the screen telling us this. So this is kind of a cool premise, actually. So it's a colonial structure. The United Federation of Great Britain, or whatever they call it, is like the fancy rich colonies. And then Australia, right, the penal colony mm-hmm. continent, is where all the workers live. And the only means of transportation on Earth, I would have loved a little featurette on the construction of this in the future, is this thing called the Fall that is essentially a tunnel drilled through the core of the Earth. So just like a kid tries to dig a hole to China, you can basically get onto this transport, drop through the entire Earth in 17 minutes, and end up in whichever one you want to go to, the colony or the Great United Federation of Great Britain.
Which was actually a really cool little sci-fi device, this center of the Earth elevator. And one of the, I think, continuously coolest action-y moments is the idea is when the Fall ship hits the core of the Earth, there's a moment of zero gravity when you're like directly in the center, which is used a few times too, I think, pretty decent effect.
Yeah, they set that up nicely at the beginning, that there's this moment that everything starts floating and you have to hang on to your keys and stuff like that. And then, of course, that's used for a really Matrix-style kind of gravity-free action sequence late in the movie.
I'm realizing now that I missed this opening text-based narration, I think. I think I sat down in the theater.
You and your popcorn.
Yeah, just as the second after it ended, and I kind of am glad I didn't, because I kind of liked having to figure everything out about this world instead of it all just being told to me.
I was trying to figure out how they would have explained the Fall otherwise. There would have had to be some really dumb moment of character exposition.
Yeah.
So even though it's a little clumsy at the end having to read all that stuff, I mean, the Fall kind of explains itself, and it is a neat, it's a really cool effect, and just kind of the idea of dropping through the Earth. I wish it had been taken a little bit longer. I think it's kind of unrealistic mm-hmm. that you could make it through the whole planet in 17 minutes.
Yeah, and I think that it plays into one of the strongest things that this movie has going for it, which is the design element.
Let's talk about the look of it, because that's something that's really different and that I think it gets right. It's not the most original design, but it's really, really cool looking, the world that they've
thought. Yeah, and we were kind of talking yesterday that it cobbles together from a lot of different sources, sci-fi movie sources, this kind of cool, specific dystopian world of half-floating skyscrapers above a kind of under city that's this great nonsensical mix of cultures and languages and...
In a very Blade Runner kind of way,
right? Yeah, it's very Blade Runner-y. Everything...
Like, you'll see a neon sign in Cyrillic characters, but it's spelling out, like, a Japanese word. And this is, of course, what the colony looks like, right?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's sort of... It's like the gritty place. So that... It looks really great.
There
I agree.
There are canals everywhere. Everything's wet constantly.
And it makes for some good chases because these buildings all are sort of these modular cubes, like, cropping out over the water so people can jump from cube to cube. And there's some fun chases in that landscape.
Yeah. So after the first act of the movie where Quaid...
Played by Colin Farrell.
Quaid, played by Colin Farrell, originally Arnold Schwarzenegger, goes and decides that he wants to get this memory implanted and things begin going awry. That's where the movies start to kind of start to significantly diverge. What starts off at first is a massive chase sequence in which Quaid runs home and realizes his wife, played by...
Kate Beckinsale.
Who was the awesomely 80s workout ensemble garbed Sharon Stone in the original, reveals herself to be not his wife, but in fact a agent sent in to guard him as his memory has been wiped and poses as his wife.
And something that I love in both movies is this happens really early on in the story, right? And essentially the rhythm is established really early on. Like, this is going to be all action all the way through, and these reversals are going to keep on happening. So you know that you can't just be satisfied with knowing that his wife is, in fact, this agent who's trying to kill him. And, in fact, pretty soon after that in the movie, we see Kate Beckinsale appear again in the guise of the loving wife saying, honey, come out of this delusion, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
She's part of the sowing of that doubt.
Which is one of the strongest things that this story has going for it is that... From its very premise, you have to accept that nothing in the story can be trusted as true, and that there's literally no way to see who is right and who is wrong if you accept the basic premise behind it. So he goes on the run. She tries to kill him. They fight forever. For literally the entire rest of the movie, it's all just breaks between Kate Beckinsale trying to kill Colin Farrell.
And here comes this is my first big conceptual problem with this movie, and it does have to do with the overuse of Kate Beckinsale, not just because I find her kind of a boring actress, although she's good in the action scenes. I mean, she's probably not doing her own stunts, but she knows martial arts well enough that she can be blended with a stunt double really well. But what's her character's motivation exactly? I mean, there's this line that she says early on, in the very first scene where it's revealed that she's, in fact, been hired to pose as his wife, and she's only known him for 6 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all a memory implant, their whole life together. And as he's freaking out, she says, I just work here, right? Which is exactly what Sharon Stone says in the original. It's a great line.
Yeah.
And Sharon Stone kind of sticks to that in the original. She just kind of shows up when she's needed by the story and is essentially employed by Cohagen, the bad guy who's trying to get him. But Kate Beckinsale in this really decides, she devotes the entire movie to fiercely chasing after him and later after the girl, Jessica Biel, right, that he hooks up with in his travels.
Melina.
And so... I guess I don't know what Kate Beckinsale's investment is. And I wanted to know at some point, I thought we were going to get some kind of a backstory scene of like, oh, but maybe she really is kind of in love with him, you know, or maybe it's not a personal motivation. Maybe she's just a really fierce, you know, I don't know. Maybe she's trying to impress her boss.
Well,
I don't know why she wants in every single moment, rather than just sicking some of her minions on him to chase after him herself.
Well, now that you're arguing this, I feel like it could be argued that there's a little subtext of her being... insulted that he's actually her match as a secret agent, despite him being this lame factory worker in their marriage life. It's like when his secret agent, Colin Farrell's secret agent, this is unlocked, he's her equal.
Right.
Her being kind of in competition with that. I think you could argue that, but it's not very explicitly.
Yeah, I wish that had been built up. I mean, I guess there is a moment that she says, oh, you were always the favorite at the academy or
something
like
that.
But if it is some kind of professional competitiveness, like that would have been a fun angle to pursue. Instead, I feel like she just kind of became the faceless assassin who was stalking him constantly.
Yeah. It literally is relentless Kate Beckinsale hunting. It's every 5 minutes he turns a corner and she's behind him with a gun.
You're right. It does become kind of comical.
So after that, through... A series of chances, kind of realizes more about his identity, including...
Well, he also keeps stumbling on taped messages from his former self, which is something
that
happens in the Verhoeven version as well. So that's kind of a cool idea. And there's all kinds of, you know, futuristic technology where you sort of have a phone inside your hand, implanted in your hand, and you have a glowing palm of your hand. And he keeps getting these messages from his former self or other self, who's named Hauser, the secret agent guy. And Hauser is sort of sending him on this wild goose chase. Go here, go there, find the key. He doesn't tell him what the key is. And he has to keep moving through the city to find clue after clue.
And the phone thing is actually where the first, I think, of many kind of explicit callbacks to kind of the great set pieces of the first Total Recall happens.
Oh, right, because it's like the nose scene, right?
Yeah, where Schwarzenegger has to pull that ludicrously large tracking device out from inside his nose. It's like the size of like a small plum that he has to pull out of his nasal cavity. And in this one, it's kind of replaced by Farrell taking the phone thing out of his hand, which is a lot more gruesome and less comical.
I thought it was kind of less gruesome in a way. I mean, Verhoeven just really doesn't – he really pulls out all the stops when it comes to, you know, violent,
maybe,
gross exploitation.
Maybe less grotesque in the classical sense of the word than the deformed nose face thing that Schwarzenegger has on.
Speaking of callbacks to the original, I missed the three-breasted woman in this. The same way you missed the exposition at the beginning, I was idiotically reaching for my notebook to write down a line someone had just said. Then I heard this tittering throughout the theater and realized that famous moment of the mutant prostitute with three breasts had briefly had its moment on scene. So you have to tell me about what that was like.
It's approximately 1 second of footage in the movie. It looks fine. It's like,
but it's full frontal three-breasted nudity.
Full frontal three-breasted nudity. It's there.
But once again, the pulp sleaze of the original is kind of gone. I mean, this in general, though, there's some moments of wit. I would say that this is a darker version in general and has more that sleek, dark, you know, post-millennial tone. It's nowhere near as campy.
Yeah, exactly. I like the phrase pulp sleaze for that because the original plays as I've mentioned before, I think kind of this perfect intersection of actual great science fiction and kind of hilarious camp at the same time, which is exemplified in scenes like the fat lady disguise that Schwarzenegger dons, where he's wearing this mechanical mask disguising him as this giant fat woman that begins to malfunction, and he kind of horrifically peels it off and reveals himself to be Schwarzenegger holding, you know, like an assault rifle or something. And it's like that combination of that just being hilarious to see that fat lady mask on reveal Schwarzenegger behind it and also just be like a cool, well-executed sci-fi effect and a great disguise to fit the story.
Yeah, there's a little callback to that in this movie. And it really, I mean, if you hadn't seen the original, this scene would basically be completely boring, right? Yeah. Which is that Colin Farrell's Quaid also dons a mask. This time it's of like a young Asian guy. But there's a person right in front of him on the line. They're going through customs in this scene as they were in the original, who looks exactly like the fat lady in the old movie. So it's a fake out. You think it's going to be her.
Everybody
then it's the
in
guy
the
behind.
Theater who was familiar with the original thought was keeping their eyes on this fat lady, and Wiseman directs you at it, but then in the background.
But then I thought that the head reveal when he took off the young Asian guy's head was going to be some really horrifically gross thing, because now we have the digital technology, right? Verhoeven was doing it all with puppets, basically.
Yeah.
There was barely any CGI in that movie. And by the same token, as long as we're hopping around the movie spoiling various things, what about the lack of a Quato? Right?
Yeah.
The fetus villain. Okay, we should describe to those who haven't seen or don't remember the original Total Recall. That when he finally penetrates to the rebel leader, right? The guy who's trying to overthrow these colonial oppressors, right?
They find this guy who you think is going to be the leader himself, who unbuttons his shirt to reveal a...
like a mutant
tiny,
fetus.
Yeah,
dwarf.
Growing out of his abdomen.
Who's the actual rebel leader,
right? Yeah, Quaid, who's psychic and reveals stuff about Quaid Hauser's psyche that he doesn't know before.
I really thought that was a huge dropped ball. I mean, maybe you don't want to recreate that exact scene, but you could do something so much cooler or so much weirder. You know, he could have like a microscopic earworm that's the rebel leader. Like, you could do anything now.
Yeah, and that scene felt like really wasted, where Hauser eventually, through various encoded messages and fake out scenes, makes his way to the rebel leader, the leader in the colonies, who's actually not in the colonies, is outside of London in their weird war gas torn fog area, who's played by Bill Nighy, and they have this very like stilted, felt like stoned in your freshman dorm scene about like the nature of reality and memory.
Yeah, that's the closest that the movie comes to the kind of Lawrence Fishburne in The Matrix sort of moment. There's also Matrix elements to this movie for sure, right?
Yeah.
But there isn't any Larry Fishburne. There isn't any kind of stoner dude in a long black coat who comes and explains it all. And that's sort of the closest we come. And it would have been worth the leaden exposition of that scene if Bill Nighy had then unbuttoned his coat and revealed some incredibly weird, gross growth that was in fact his master.
Yeah, exactly.
But that never happened.
But then instead, Bryan Cranston playing Cohegan, the officious villain of the movie just shows up and shoots him. Kind of an anticlimactic scene that segues into the end of the movie, which involves basically a showdown between Colin Farrell and Bryan Cranston.
With Kate Beckinsale, of course, buzzing around at all times in various hovercrafts.
And Jessica Biel also in the background helping out slash getting captured.
God, Jessica Biel, so boring that I forgot she was even in this movie. Okay, actually, I want to talk about the performances and the casting before we wrap, but let's first take a break for a word from our sponsor.
Great.
So the Spoiler Special, as ever, is delighted to be sponsored by Audible.com, the leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the web. They have more than 100,000 audiobooks you can listen to on any device, including whatever you're listening to us on right now. And they have a good deal right now for Spoiler listeners. You can get a 30-day free trial of the service and one free audiobook if you sign up at this URL, audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. So as always, we try to recommend something that's related to the topic of the day. So I entered Philip K. Dick's name into Audible, the science fiction writer who wrote this story, also the story that Minority Report is based on.
Also the story that Blade Runner is based on. Yeah.
And Richard Linklater made A Scanner Darkly, one of his novels, into a film. He's a very cinematic author in many ways, a very noir kind of style, and really, really great science fiction ideas. He also had a really interesting and sad life and was essentially mentally ill. And I think a lot of these stories about, you know, is this real, is it not, these kind of epistemological riddles that he specializes in, had a lot to do with his lived experience. So there's a bunch both by and about Philip K. Dick on Audible. You can, and there's some really good people reading it, too. For example, Paul Giamatti reading A Scanner Darkly, the Philip K. Dick novel. And although I'm sitting here raving about Philip K. Dick, I haven't actually read that much by him, but one thing I have read is this novel, A Scanner Darkly, and it's fantastic. Such a great book, and I would love to hear it in Paul Giamatti's voice. Okay, so you can find all of those on audible.com, and don't forget to use this code audiblepodcast.com/culturefest. So there were a couple more things that you wanted to spoil, just little moments, little twists in the movie. There's so many, we can't go through them all. Mm-hmm. But for example, one twist that stood out for you and sort of showed how this movie kind of doesn't do what it's trying to do as well as the 1990 original.
Yeah, and as we mentioned before, this it seems like this movie is not as interested in the kind of epistemological questions that are at the center of this, which is a scene in which Colin Farrell is held up with Jessica Biel, who he's trying to escape with, in a hotel lobby or lobby of something, and he's surrounded by cops, and his buddy from his previous life as a welder comes in and says, "Don't shoot, man. Recall sent me in.
I'm a chemical implant in your brain right now.
This is all a dream. You're on the table in recall. This is the memory that you had asked to have implanted, and you're fighting it. And you need to shoot Jessica Biel in order
to choose reality
and wake up from this dream." And it's kind of this tense standoff moment of who's going to get shot, who's going to get shot, what is he going to choose? Is he going to believe his friend? Is he going to believe the reality that he's perceiving around him? And he ends up shooting his old friend and going with Jessica Biel for another 40 minutes of being chased by Kate Beckinsale. And it wasn't as mentally tense because in the original, there's that great moment that you reminded me of where instead of a friend from a past life, it's kind of this, to use more Matrix metaphors, an architect-like person who's sent in to tell him that he's having this schizoid embolism, Schwarzenegger, that he's having this schizoid embolism and that he needs to shoot his rebel accomplice in order to wake up. And the standoff moment is resolved by Schwarzenegger aiming the gun at the official, the recall official being sent in, and who says, "I don't care, I'm not real, this is a dream, shoot
me. Right, go ahead and shoot me."
But then Schwarzenegger notices a single bead of sweat dropping down this guy's forehead, realizes that he's bluffing, and shoots him and continues with the rest of the mission. And it's like kind of that great in this original movie that's so campy and so over the top in a lot of ways, that like moment that brings it down to that great sci-fi DNA where it's like actually making the main characters ask real questions about the reality they perceive and the reality they're experiencing, that this remake is less interested in and more in favor of.
Right, and the tell is kind of shifted in this scene. There is also a moment where, because of a bodily fluid, the hero decides who to shoot. But what the bodily fluid is a tear rolling out of Jessica Biel's eye because he thinks, okay, I am going to choose reality. I'm going to believe my old buddy from the plant, and I'm going to shoot the Jessica Biel character. And then as he does, there's a single tear that rolls out of her eye. And then he turns and shoots the friend. But if she were some sort of hologram implant who had been designed to trick him, they obviously would have equipped her with tears to make her yet more, you know, adorable and pleasing. So it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Which is why this movie seems to end in a lot less of an ambiguous way. And I still feel like in the original Recall, you could go back and ask, well, is he still dreaming? Is it a reality? As the oxygen sweeps back over Mars and he's looking out to that sun that kind of explodes in light as the movie ends. Like, is that a dream or is that him embracing his schizoid embolism? I'm going to say that as many times as I can. Whereas this movie kind of ends with Bryan Cranston trying to invade the colonies with his robot army. Oh, also, there's a plot about a robot army in this.
Who look exactly like the stormtroopers from Star Wars, basically.
Exactly. Bryan Cranston's going to take this army and invade the colonies for his own political gain.
Bryan Cranston and the robot army is just a really boring part of the movie, essentially. Yeah. And I mean, I say that with all love for Bryan Cranston, but it really, really did seem like, oh, we've got to up the scale. We've got to make it bigger than the original, you know. And in fact, bringing air to Mars is so much more of a humanitarian gesture.
So they are going to take the fall elevator to the colonies. They're fighting on top of it, Cranston and Farrell. Farrell blows everything up. And that's kind of how it ends.
I do like fighting on top of the fall elevator because you know at that point somebody is ending up at the core of the Earth,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
This is a serious elevator shaft fall for the villain.
Yeah, which you think is Kate Beckinsale as she's falling down, but she manages to escape and try to kill Hauser one more time. If we're going to move on to the performances, I think I'd like to start with Cranston just because it's as somebody who's like consummately following Breaking Bad. It is at this point just weird to see him outside of that character since he inhabits it so much, like so completely when you're watching the series. It almost feels like watching Walter White like cameo in something else as like a slightly, at this point, more lighthearted
villain.
It's
strange how a great TV role will do that to an actor like Gandolfini, right? He's just permanently Tony Soprano'd. He cannot escape.
Exactly. Although I will say I admire Weissman for continuing Bryan Cranston's so far trope of being the victim of knife violence in his major motion pictures, whether it's his gruesome forced suicide in Drive or just being stabbed with his own knife by Farrell in this movie. I look forward to hopefully many more knife violent
Cranston,
knife ends
Cranston stabbings. What about the girls? What did you think of Jessica Biel and Kate Beckinsale? And did it bother you that they're such similar types?
Yes, there were definitely moments where, especially in a movie that's going to play with you not realizing or maybe not knowing who is who and who is being who, they look almost exactly the same. It's like there's a part where he's waking up after.
Oh, that's
like
right. One of them
brunette.
Is digitally disguised as the other, but you think, why even bother with the disguise? You're both lissom, brunette, willowy, whatever.
Colin Farrell, totally serviceable action star.
And actually somewhat more believable as an everyman than Arnold Schwarzenegger, although so much of the joy of the original comes from the total absurdity that just your everyday working schmo would look like Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I mean, I think one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's greatest credits to himself as an actor is being able to convince America that he could play an everyman. Oh, yeah, Arnold Schwarzenegger, 300-pound slab of muscle Austrian man, totally an insurance adjuster.
Well, and he has this way. It's a very fun role to play, I'm sure, this Douglas Quaid role, because you get to be really badass. You get to wipe out huge quantities of villains. There's a high body count in both movies. Not quite as visibly high a body count, especially of civilians in this, as there were in the Verhoeven, but the same kind of idea. Just people falling right and left. But at the same time, the hero has this kind of innocence, because he sort of didn't ask to be put there, right? He's amazed at his own abilities. He suddenly became this super agent.
Constantly surprised by everything around him.
And I think that's played up a little bit more, you know, more playfully in the Verhoeven. But Colin Farrell carries it off okay. I mean, in general, I think, aren't we saying this is a perfectly serviceable science fiction summer action movie for what it is?
I think the bottom line is, that's exactly how I would say it. It's, you know, it's going to, if you're a fan of the original, it's going to hit a few pleasure points in the callbacks. It's definitely, you know, not going to live up to the same transcendental greatness, I think, as the first one. But, you know, it plays with what you might, with what you expect, and it's going to reward it in a few ways. And other than that, you know, it's a well-designed, well-executed. Weissman does great action scenes. People are getting beat up. There's good sci-fi technology elements. It's great.
Yeah, I think I would recommend it with that mild reservation that, you know, if you're looking for either Philip K. Dick or Paul Verhoeven, you're not going to find that. But you're going to find somebody else's reading of a really, really cool science fiction premise. All right. Well, Chris, thanks a lot for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Next time we've got a sci-fi favorite of yours, please come in and spoil again.
Absolutely. It would be my pleasure.
Okay, our producer is you, Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.